Good morning. You're tuned in to Listen Local, the bi-weekly webcast from your neighborhood news source, Mission Local, brought to you via BFF.fm. There's a whole mess of things on the ballot this year, and within that mess, there are several proposals that will shape housing policy in the city for years to come. We thought we'd chat this week about what those measures would do and what their local effects would be. After that, we'll look at crime and safety in the neighborhood. The city might be getting a new police chief within a few weeks, but in the meantime, officers are trying to deal with an uptick in violence on local streets. With me are Joe Urbano-Barros. Hey, Joe.
Hey, good morning.
And Laura Waxman.
Good morning.
So there are five measures that relate to housing on the ballot this November. There's Proposition C, which would authorize $260 million in bonds to fund affordable housing. Prop O, which would allow for office construction over a previously set limit at Hunters Point. Prop P, which would require the city to solicit more bids for the construction of affordable housing. U, which would raise the cap on incomes that could be considered for affordable housing. And X, which means that if developers are removing arts and trade spaces in their proposed buildings, this would require them to replace some of it. We want to focus specifically on the last three, since it seems they'd have a more direct impact here in this neighborhood. Several projects proposed in this area have faced serious opposition over arts and trade spaces previously. But maybe we could get a walkthrough from Joe, because Joe's been writing at least about some of these proposals.
Yeah, so on X, the last one specifically, which is the one that would preserve the arts and trade space, which is known in the city as PDR, which is production, distribution, and repair. And you'll see this term used a lot in housing wars, and it's a little wonky, but it basically just means space that can be used for manufacturing or art space. And you can also use it to have a kind of a retail component up front. So think of someone who is, there's a lot on Treat Street where you're making maybe some art in the back and then you're selling it in the front, or you could use the whole thing for an auto shop or something like that. I mean, it kind of varies a lot. And what this proposition does is it basically requires developers in the Mission District and SoMa to reserve 50 to 100% of the PDR space that they're replacing. So if someone is building housing on top of an auto shop, and that housing is, or the auto shop is like 5,000 or 10,000 square feet of PDR, they'd have to replace 50 to 100% of that depending on where the development's located.
So does this mean that they would have to give the auto shop their space back?
No, the auto shop's gone. It's just for the zoning. Mm-hmm. So the only requirement is that the ground floor, or basically that you include the same amount of this type of zoning, of this arts and trade space, in the next building. So you could build a five-story housing development, and the auto shop does not get a right to return because commercial businesses don't have that in California. Mm-hmm. And then you can rent it out to whoever you want. And actually, one of the big concerns with this is that from opponents of the measure is that they say, well, this is not going to give you affordable space for that auto dealer because A, the auto dealer's out, and B, in order for a developer to make this type of project work with this requirement, they're going to have to hold that PDR space at a really high rent. So
what is this whole thing for the for those of us who don't follow housing policy every day of our lives? Why do we care about PDR space? What's so important about it?
Yeah, well, I think it ties into the whole, I mean, gentrification has had a dual effect of pushing out minorities from the Mission District, and also pushing out, when you see this a lot, artists. And it's really born from a concern with that, and also a concern that nonprofits and blue-collar workers don't have the space they need anymore, that nonprofits themselves are being displaced from the city. And you kind of see this, you've seen this when Twitter came in and the whole Twitter tax break. One of the big concerns raised by progressives on the left is that, well, they used to know a lot of nonprofits that were in mid-market area. And I think, Laura, you wrote about a tenants group a while ago that was priced out of their building so that WeWork could go in there.
Right, they took over the whole building. And one of the problems with that, too, was, you know, just the resources. People know where to go. People know that that's there. And for all those nonprofits to be kind of split up or displaced or just leaving the city entirely was the problem.
Right. And so this PDR space, it's a little misleading that it's just arts and trade, because it could also be used by nonprofits. It's kind of a really versatile zoning. And one of the big concerns is for artists, for nonprofits, and for blue collar workers. And the latter especially is a concern because actually we have seen an uptick in the demand for PDR work, for blue collar work, which is a little counterintuitive because you would think that during gentrification, you just want office space and the types of jobs that are associated with that. But if you have a lot more people in the city, you also need manufacturers and people who are doing distribution of goods. People who fix your car. And I think a lot of it, of these new jobs, have actually been in the production. So it's kind of, it's small scale manufacturers, and it might be kind of more boutique-y. And that's one of the concerns, is that really if you require developers to do this, they're going to hold this space, sure, but they're going to rent it out to people who are making boutique goods, and it's not going to preserve the type of space that the measure was meant to do. It's not going to preserve affordable space for nonprofits, for struggling artists, mm-hmm. and for real blue-collar workers, instead of just kind of the fancier, higher-end boutique manufacturers.
So that's the primary opposition to this measure, is that people will say it just won't do what it's intended to do?
It won't do what it's intended to do. Another one is that, well, this will just kill housing. If you require developers to do more things, some projects will not pencil out and they will not be built. So we will just have less housing as a result. And then a third opposition, which is, I think, pretty valid, is that this is a complicated land use question. And why the hell are the voters deciding this question? I mean, why can't the Board of Supervisors decide this for us? I mean, that's what we elected them to do. And you could ask that about, like, almost everyone.
Well, yeah, you can bring that up in all cases. And there's always an argument like, well, is this important enough to go to the voters? Yes, the voters should decide because it's such an important issue, as opposed to, is this important enough for the Board of Supervisors to make a decision?
And sometimes that's not valid, because sometimes the city charter requires that you go to the voters. Mm-hmm. To change the city charter, you have to go to the voters. Mm-hmm. And some things are changes to the charter. But this is just a legislative thing, and it's a land use. I mean, land use, I have a hard time following this stuff, and I've reported on this. So the ordinary voter, and especially a low-informed voter, I mean, is not going to think about this for 2 seconds. They're not going to understand what PDR means. They're not going to understand about what is 50 to 100% the right rate. They're not going to understand about why is it in the Mission and the Soma and not other places in the city.
Oh, it's restricted to two areas?
It's just those two areas, Wow. So it's not a citywide thing.
Is there a particular reason for that?
Because those are the areas that are traditionally have this space anyway. The Mission has a huge north and east kind of industrial sector where there's a lot of manufacturers, and so does the Soma, or at least it used to have more of that before the housing boom, the tech boom. And the rest of the city doesn't have these, and those are the areas where really you have strong activist groups who have pushed Supervisor Jane Kim, who represents the Soma, into crafting this measure and putting it on the ballot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've talked a little bit extensively now about Proposition X. And no, it's good, because these are, like you said, complicated issues. But then we have even more complication, because we're also being asked to vote on Props P and U. And I'm not sure. We wrote a story about them sort of linked, although I think they're quite disparate issues. So Proposition P.
Right. I always get these confused. So I think
P is the one about bidding on affordable housing.
Right. So this one, and it really, well, okay. So this one would require that when the city has a site that it wants to build fully affordable housing on, it has to put out bids for that site, and then nonprofit
solicit bids,
and then nonprofit developers make bids, and then the city selects the best one. And this one,
bid is essentially them being like, this is what I'm going to build here if you pick me.
Yeah, it's a plan for the building, and it's a plan for, it's not just a plan for the building, but it's also like, how am I going to finance this building? Are your sources of financing secure? Because the city is not providing most of this money at all. The nonprofit has to go to the federal government, to the state government, to private actors for private grants, or sometimes to investors who actually see a return on this.
Mm-hmm.
And so the city wants to know, do you have your financing straight, and a host of other things. And so then it chooses what it thinks is the best proposal. And what this would do, this Proposition P, is require that the city get three of these proposals for a project before awarding it out. The problem is that the city never gets three proposals right. for a project, almost
the
never.
The question, why have they not already gotten this on the regular?
And so, I mean, what this proposition is really meant to do, and this is really kind of inside baseball, is that there's a group called the Council of Community Housing Organizations that gets a lot of these nonprofit developers, which are the ones that would make the bids together, and they kind of all together as a group decide which ones they'll bid for. And so what this proposition is aimed at doing is breaking up that power and really creating more of a free-for-all so that everyone is bidding, is putting together what the supporters of this proposition believe to be worthwhile bids. Mm-hmm. And then it also, I forget exactly what the criteria is, but it changes why the city should, it might be that it's the lowest cost proposal. Like what it, the city must choose the proposal that builds the most units at the lowest cost.
So it sounds like this is aimed at reducing spending, reducing fiscal waste.
It's aimed It's aimed at reducing the power of this group, this council, and it's aimed at getting what they think to be the most bang for your buck, the mm-hmm. most units for dollars spent mm-hmm. on city subsidy. One of the problems is that, well, you don't necessarily want cheap housing, and a lot of these affordable housing developments have, you know, nonprofit space on the ground floor or light industrial space or art space that do not translate to units but still serve some sort of community benefit.
Right.
And that's a real problem. And the glaring one is that, well, if the city does not get three proposals now, and if that trend continues, then you will just not be able to build affordable housing.
Oh, because you're stuck in this with the requirement. You have to reach that hurdle of three bids.
Yeah.
And if there aren't three bids, you're stuck.
Right. And it's not clear what defines a bid. I mean, maybe it doesn't matter because then, you know, other nonprofits can just send a piece of paper saying, this is a bid, and like, it's not a real thing.
Like a little sketch of a
right,
house
like,
on it.
Right, like whatever. But if it's if it must be a real bid, these things are not easy. These things take months and they spend a lot of resources, and it would be onerous for these affordable housing builders to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the problem with P.
And then when it's
U, right?
And then when it's built, Prop U, right, comes
Prop
into play.
U.
I mean, it also comes into play. Proposition U is the proposal that would raise the cap on incomes that could be considered for affordable housing, meaning previously, if you made X amount, you could be considered, or you could maybe not be considered, and now you can.
Right. Maybe you could look up the exact percentages, but right now I believe rental is at 55% of area median income, which just means you have to make a little more than half of what the average for the San Francisco is, which is already quite high because that median is brought up by all the new tech workers we have.
That's for low income, right?
That's low income. That's defined low income. And I think this would almost more than double it. I think it's up to either 100% or 120% of area median income. And the problem with this is like it's made from some motivation that you need to preserve space for middle income earners in the city, which is all fine and well. But this does it at the expense of the low income bracket. It's not adding more housing. It's taking the housing that you already have that's open to low-income workers and saying it's not only just open to low-income people, it's now also open to middle-income people.
Right. It's just widening the pool of people who may apply,
who can apply.
Is great for people who previously felt excluded because they cannot apply for this and they feel like, well, I make money, but I don't make enough to compete on the market.
Right.
But,
But it's
now
the same number of spots for double more, who knows how many people. And it's a real problem because already, if we're just restricting it to low-income people, we had a project in the Fillmore, I think, or Western Addition that had 94 units, and it got 5,000 applications. I mean, so there's already just huge demand for this, mm-hmm. doubling that. And, you know, maybe middle-income people are better prepared to apply for this. Maybe they'll make better proposals. Just because they can get their paperwork in order, whatever, who knows?
Yeah,
there could be some discrimination there too. As
far right,
as it goes.
Effectively, I'm sure you would have to hold some of it still for low income, but what it does essentially is it doubles the pool. You're right, like the same number of housing, more people are eligible.
So just to give people an idea of this, drawing here from the San Francisco Public Press's election guide, which is an excellent resource, highly recommend it. To qualify, a single-person household must have an annual income that is at most $41,450 a year. A two-person household may earn up to $47,400 a year. And a three-person household may earn up to $53,300 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a little bit of variation. Plus, this is for rental rather than for purchase,
right,
which is a little bit different.
Higher, yeah.
But that gives you just a general idea of what the cap is. So if you earn above that, I mean, some of you might, and you might not consider yourself to be a high-income earner, but you would currently not qualify for that housing.
Right. And do you know what the level would be if this proposition were to pass? I think it's quite a bit. I think it's almost double. I mean, if I understand correctly, you would be able to earn like around $100,000, which, you know, I don't doubt that people who are earning $100,000 are still struggling somewhat in the city, but is that the best use of our affordable housing resources? I'm not so sure.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's it. Those are the major housing ballot propositions as far as I know. I mean, there's a couple others, but those are the big
ones. Those are the ones I think that would have the biggest impact hyper-locally. When we say locally, I think it's always a little
Mission
confusing.
Mission district local.
Mission area-ish. Well, there's actually another somewhat more difficult and heartbreaking issue that we have to talk about today, that people also care really deeply about. It's safety and policing. There's a lot going on there these days. Last weekend, a man who had been shot in June of this year succumbed to his injuries, and this Saturday, two people were injured in Bernal Heights in a shooting, and on Sunday, a 13-year-old boy was shot and critically injured in a shooting at 26th and Valencia Streets. Laura has been following up with friends, family, neighbors, people affected by this violence. What have people been saying? I mean, what's going on?
It's definitely been a heavy couple of weeks, would say. I mean, it all started, you know, in June. I think that's when people kind of pegged that crime wave. You know, there were two friends shot within a week of each other on 24th and Shotwell Street, and that kind of really worried the neighbors. There was a police meeting after that. People were reporting that they weren't feeling safe. People were saying that there was an increase in crime, increase in shootings. Actually, last night at a police commission meeting, interim chief, what's his name, Tony Chaplin, Tony Chaplin said there was an increase in gun violence up from last year, 7%.
Citywide. Yeah. When we cite those statistics, the statistics I just talked about, the numbers there, those are just for the kind of Mission District and area that includes Bernal Heights, because a lot of people in the Mission heard about that. But there have been a number of shootings in the city, yeah.
You know, in the Mission, people are feeling it, especially in that on that 24th Street corridor.
Mm-hmm.
And, the man that you were referring to earlier, who was shot in June, he succumbed, died of his injuries last week. There was a vigil a week later. It seems that there was an altercation between two really young children, 13-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is in the hospital now with life-threatening injuries. I don't think we know what his condition is.
We haven't heard from the police an update on his condition. At first, when it was reported he had non-life-threatening injuries.
Right.
Later, an item in the crime blotter, a recap that we get every day, indicated that his injuries were life-threatening.
Right, and so just speaking with some of the people, the residents, and also some of the activists, you know, that are working to prevent violence, it sounds like these kids are getting younger and younger and are being armed younger, and I think that really poses a problem for
a
lot
absolutely.
Of people. You know, I spoke with Mei Chow from Karasen, and she is formerly, you know, was a gang member in the Mission and now works to prevent violence among young kids. And she was saying that sometimes in the summer there is an uptick in violence, just because kids are out of school, tempers flare, it's hot, I don't know. Captain Perea of Mission Station doesn't seem to think so. He was saying that this is kind of an all-around thing and doesn't necessarily happen.
An all-around, as like it happens the entire year.
It happens, right.
So what are how are the police responding to this?
The police are responding by basically, you know, it's looking for people who are on probation or on parole and making arrests.
Okay, so they're targeting specifically people who have
right.
a prior record of some kind of violent
right.
crime?
At the same time, it seems that they do have more of a lax approach to making arrests, especially of, you know, children. We see that with prostitution on Chatwell Street and on Cap Streets. Their approach is more to really kind of nip the problem in the bud,
mm-hmm.
by, you know, looking for the Johns, looking for the customers, looking for the pimps, and really connecting the younger people who are being sex trafficked, who are prostituting, to resources. And
yeah, it sounds like that's the central focus here of preventing crime among young people is giving them an alternative.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, Mei Chow from Karasen was saying, you know, I was talking to her and asking kind of what the kids are saying that she works with. And those kids are saying, we want money, we want jobs, mm-hmm. you know, we want opportunities. And that's, it's probably not in those words, but they want their hustle.
Yeah.
And I think, but I think, you know, just connecting kids to that and it starts in the schools. That's what it sounds like. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of this violence. She was saying that really caseworkers need to be in schools with kids as early as third grade.
Right.
Because that's when it starts. And she said that middle schoolers are completely neglected. You know, there's outreach in high schools. There's a focus on high schoolers. But at middle school, when people start, you know, kind of figuring out what they want to do and hanging out with the wrong crowds, that's completely neglected.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Also, just to add on to that, you know, she was saying there was a cut in caseworker programs, and that was in 2009, I believe, or 2010, and that has really affected kind of what's going on now, because caseworkers, you know, working with kids one-on-one on a case-by-case basis is really important, and, you know, not having those resources is a problem.
Yeah, and if kids are getting involved in these kinds of things so young, that to me that speaks to a sense that they might not feel safe going to school or hanging out even when they're very young.
Right. Carlos Cookie Gonzalez, who is a former probation worker, I believe he's a muralist, he was saying, you know, that a lot of those kids, like, he had that same experience when he was growing up in San Francisco, and he said it's not cool to be, you know, in school and nerdy, and a lot of people get bullied, and a lot of people have a lot of things to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's safer sometimes to be hard and to be associated with gangs, whether you're in it or not, you know, or to hang out with those kind of people.
Which really only then ends up exacerbating the problem of not being able to access opportunities that other children and young adults might be able to, not finding a job, not having an income in an increasingly gentrifying community where survival is more and more difficult. Is gentrification playing a role in this from what you've heard?
That's what I've heard from, you know, the people who are working directly with these kids, that, you know, first of all, there's that loss of identity in a way, you know, your loss of your friends, your resources, being displaced. A lot of, this is just what I've heard, you know, I have no way to prove this, but a lot of kids are barting in from other places and hanging out in their old hangouts, like on 24th Street or wherever. You know, that's what some of the activists are saying. And that a lot of the residents on 24th Street, too, who I spoke to months ago about another shooting, were saying that they don't recognize the people that are standing on their block.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, they're not from here. Like, we know the people who grew up here. We know the faces. And some of these faces are not familiar.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, from here or not from here is sort of a difficult topic, no matter what bigger topic it's a part of, because some, you know, you may not recognize somebody who is from a different generation or a different social circle or something, and you might not consider them from here or vice versa.
But I think that just shows, you know, that gentrification does play a role.
Sure, yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, I think people have this perception that gentrification will sort of clean up a neighborhood or will reduce crime in an area, and that doesn't seem to be, I mean, at least from what we're seeing in terms of shootings here, they certainly have not been prevented by gentrification. I think it's hard to argue that Valencia and 26th Street have not been gentrified, and there was just a shooting there, you know, this last weekend.
Right. Well, and I mean, I think another thing to note is that there has been, while violence has gone down nationwide for, you know, two decades, there has been a recent uptick in violent crime in major cities.
Mm-hmm.
So this is part of some sort of nationwide trend that, you know, might all have local causes, but is also part of something that we don't quite understand yet. And the gentrification thing is interesting because all cities are kind of experiencing gentrification. So you're going to keep having these questions of violent crime existing alongside the fact that, you know, you're having higher earners coming into a city, taking reduced housing stock.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there's a link there, but it's just an interesting coexistence.
Right.
A difficult coexistence. Yeah.
And on the flip side, another thing that I thought was very interesting and really scary at the same time was the fact that these kids have guns, and it sounds like, you know, speaking to some people who've been in this for a long time, that guns were not that readily available 10, 20 years ago, and now they are, you know, and I Gonzalez, the probation officer, was telling me, you know, we used to knuckle it out and people who had guns were kind of like looked down upon, you know, and now it's like you have to have a gun to kind of coexist or survive or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least that's the perception.
Right.
But interestingly, there's also on the flip side, there is a flip side, which is that neighbors have been saying that a police sort of enforcement effort targeted at prostitution on Cap and Shotwell Streets, which you mentioned earlier, has worked.
Right.
That it has been reduced. So what happened there? How did they do this?
What I've heard is that it's just patrolling, foot patrols. You know, neighbors have asked for that and sounds like they're getting it. And just kind of really combing the areas that are of concern. They were also saying, you know, they had other tactics like much increased traffic stops, which could also, I think...
Traffic stops for, like, traffic violations?
Yeah. And like.
So what does that have to do with prostitution?
Just to kind of divert people, uh-huh. you know, and DUI stops. Mm-hmm. They erected some DUI stops there. So I think it's just diverting people and kind of focusing on people who have already been, you know, in the system, those kind of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all this is going on, you know, this is sort of the daily grind, I suspect, of the police department, things that, of course, are their jobs and they have to do,
right.
while the entire department is sort of in turmoil. I mean, the Department of Justice, the Federal Department of Justice, just released a review of the police department that pretty much slams it on all fronts. I mean, mm-hmm. there's issues with transparency, accountability, bias, data collection, oversight, the influence of the Police Officers Association. There's all sorts of things going on there, and a new chief is being chosen.
So much to go talk about. It's a little time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But just give us an update on the police chief situation, because you were at the police commission last night, right?
Right. So last night, you know, there was the regular police commissioner meeting. They did have a closed session halfway through, and that was when they were supposed to discuss the finalists for the recommendations that they would forward to the mayor.
Mm-hmm.
And the mayor, there were rumors that the mayor would today appoint a new chief. Apparently that didn't happen, at least not that I know of, as of this moment.
There was a possibility that today would bring us a new chief.
But it hasn't happened.
Okay, and
so
what's the timeline?
They gave a new
it?
Timeline, mm-hmm. and they said 3 to 4 weeks.
Okay. Well, we have more reporting coming out on all of this, so stay tuned for that. We will be back 2 weeks from now with news and notes from the neighborhood. If you know something we don't that you think we should, shoot us an email at info@missionlocal.com. You can also find us on Facebook, facebook.com/missionlocalsf, or tweet at us. Our handle is @MLNow. This also brings the Thursday morning talk session to an end. Stay tuned for music, emotion, and just a roller coaster of all things emotion on Abuela's Pantry up next. Thanks for listening.